All right, well, good afternoon, everyone. I'm Rob Atkinson, and I'm president of ITIF, so I want to welcome you here, particularly on a cold, rainy Friday afternoon. I feel like we should have pizza and beer. This would kind of sort of make it a lot more fun, but well, the next best thing. So I want to welcome you to an event here to talk about or discuss a new book that a colleague of mine, Eric Bernholtzman, has written with Adam Sanders, Wired for Innovation, How Information Technology is Reshaping the Economy. Eric sent me this book as a draft, I think, to review and give some comments on a few months ago, and I was just so impressed with it. I was impressed with it for two reasons. One is it's 152 pages long, so it's not really too long, and I don't think there's a single equation in the book. So both of those things coming from a distinguished economist is kind of anomalous. So I definitely encourage you to get this book. It is a real pleasure to have Eric here. Eric is a, among other things, he's an affiliated expert at ITIF, and we've certainly followed his work for many, many years because I think he is really by far the leading expert in the world on the role of IT and economic growth, productivity, and business effects and reengineering and the like. So he is the director of the MIT Center for Digital Business and the Schlussel Family Professor of Information Technology and Strategy at the MIT Sloan School. He lectures worldwide on business strategy and performance, pricing models, and intangible assets, and he teaches courses on the economics of information at the Sloan School. He's one of the first researchers to measure the productivity contributions of IT. His research has been recognized with 9 Best Paper Awards and 5 patents. This must be business process patents we're talking about here. Business Week has profiled him as one of the 5 e-business visionaries. And a reader's poll by Optimize magazine ranked him as one of the world's 2 most influential academics. I wonder who number one was.
No comment.
Okay. A competitor. He's also the editor or co-editor, author or co-editor of several books, including Understanding the Digital Economy, Intangible Assets and Strategies for E-Business Success. He's been served a number of academic editorial boards, as well as Time Magazine's Board of Economists. He has a master's and a bachelor's from Harvard in mathematics and decision sciences, and a PhD from MIT in managerial economics. And most recently, he comes directly from a meeting with Chairman Bernanke to talk about how innovation is affecting the economy now and its prospects for recovery. So what we're going to do, Eric's probably going to talk for about 45 minutes, go through a lot of the content of the book. We'll have plenty of time then for questions and discussion, and we will adjourn certainly no later than 4:30. So thank you, Eric.
Thank you, Rob. Actually, it's the first time I had to lower the microphone. Usually it's the other way around. So thanks so much for inviting me here. It's a delight to get a chance to share some of the research findings. And I did manage to get rid of the equations. Hal Varian, who's now chief economist at Google, gave me some advice. He said that every equation you put in your book cuts the sales in half. So I didn't have much of a base to start with, so I thought I better not do that. But this work came out of some research we've been doing at the Center for Digital Business at MIT, where I'm the director. There are a number of companies that support the work there, and we were getting a lot of requests to sort of summarize and give an overview of the work that of how IT was affecting innovation and how it was changing the economy. And so we wrote up this report, and then we decided to make it more broadly available in the form of this this book, Wired for Innovation. So my plan today, let's see if this button here, that's a decoy. Let's see. This button doesn't work. Just to show you how well technology can work. Here we go.
All right, try that now.
Yep, okay, very good, thank you. Okay. Is to talk about this the book, Wired for Innovation, and although it is a short book, and covers a lot of different topics. I'm not going to be able to go through all of these issues. I'm just going to pick a few of them to focus on, and I welcome some interactions and Q&A as we go along, as well as at the end. Feel free to raise your hand and comment or ask questions as I go through it. The part I'm going to focus on is these middle two sections, which actually is what I talked about over at the Fed this morning as well, some of the business practices that enhance productivity and the role of organizational capital and the changes that we see from that. So it's worth taking a moment to just define productivity, which is a key issue. Productivity is very important to the economy. It's ultimately what determines all of our living standards. It's what determines the competitive advantage of individual companies. It's what determines the wealth of nations. So it's a key driver of our prosperity. But people have a lot of different kinds of definitions of it. I don't know if any of you want to try and define productivity. How is productivity used? How is that word used in your organizations? So the way economists define productivity is actually fairly simple. It's output divided by input, and that output can take different forms. And conceptually, that's very easy. Turns out to be very difficult to actually measure it. In fact, there's two parts of it that are difficult to measure. One of them is output, the other one is input. The output is difficult because to really do productivity correctly, you need to capture all the different sources of value. And one of the ironies of the information age is that although we have better and better and more detailed data, it's becoming harder and harder to capture the true nature of output and the true sources of value. It was easier to count, say, bushels of wheat or tons of steel or cars coming off an assembly line. But today, if you look at the quality, variety, timeliness, customer service, and a lot of the intangible outputs, those are often what drives the benefits to consumers, and it should be counted as part of output, but aren't very easy to quantify and measure as part of GDP, and I think increasingly are being missed from GDP and also from the outputs of individual sectors and companies. Inputs are also very difficult to measure. On the input side, it's very common to use this denominator labor input, and you get labor productivity. But a broader understanding, you should also include capital and other inputs, in particular, intangible inputs, some of the organizational capital and other kinds of inputs that don't usually show up in the income statements or in the national accounts. Now, if productivity is what is driving our wealth, we should understand where productivity comes from. So where does it come from? Well, by definition, it doesn't come from working more hours or putting more labor input, just working harder. That may affect total output, but it does that by affecting the denominator input as well. And similarly, if you use more capital or more other types of resources, those aren't going to affect a broad measure of productivity like multi-factor productivity. Instead, productivity comes from using your inputs more effectively, from working smarter in some way. And historically, economists have found that that comes from new technologies and new techniques of production. In particular, one class of technologies has turned out to be very important in history in driving productivity, and that's what economists call general purpose technologies. These are technologies that can be used in a broad set of different applications, not just one use. So the steam engine or electricity are two examples of general purpose technologies that set off waves of complementary innovations and thereby raise productivity of multiple sectors of the economy. Today, the general purpose technology that's the most important one of our era is obviously information technology, and it's setting off a cascade of complementary innovations. Historically, productivity growth has varied, but in the 70s, 80s, and early 90s, it was only up a little over 1%, 1.4% or something like that per year. Since 1995, productivity growth has gone up quite a bit, to the high 2%, some years over 3%, and in fact, last quarter, over 6%. I believe it's going to be very high this coming quarter as well. This uptick in productivity starting around 1995 has been closely linked to the spread of information technology in the economy. And this was controversial at first, and I did some of the early papers on that, but there's now pretty much a consensus among economists that the lion's share of the productivity gains from this resurgence can be traced to better use of information technology and more use of information technology, especially in the U.S. economy. It hasn't happened as much in other parts of the world that haven't been as aggressive about using information technology. You can also see it at the individual firm level, and here's some a scatter plot of some data from a collection of large U.S.-based firms that we did, where we did a study. And there's a couple things that are interesting to see in this chart. One is that, on average, the more IT-intensive firms, each of those little crosses there represents a firm, tend to be more productive. But also, you see that there's a tremendous amount of variation in the firms. And you can think of each of those as there's a story behind each of those, some of them using IT very successfully, some not so successfully. And it's easy to see that it's quite possible, is this a laser? Yeah. It's quite possible that you could spend a lot on IT and not get great returns, and there are many firms that are in that quadrant over there. But there's others that spent just as much and got much higher returns. Now, by definition, the difference between those firms is not their IT spending, at least in terms of the quantity of spending. And since our productivity measure here controls for all the different inputs that we could measure, labor, capital, and other inputs, purchase services, materials, it's not in those other inputs as well. So what is it that differentiates them? Well, it has to do with the way they're using it and some of the intangible inputs. And so my research, while early on it was looking at whether there was a relationship between IT and productivity, the more recent research and what we discuss more in the book now has to do with what are the practices that differentiate the high performers from the low performers. Are there some things that are systematically different, some generalizable principles that we can identify? Because after all, productivity is not like a certificate of deposit where you can, or IT is not like a certificate of deposit where you can put down your investment and then get some kind of a guaranteed expected rate of return. Depending on how you use the technology, you could end up actually losing a great deal of money or being very successful, and that's going to depend on the way you use it. So diving down more deeply and looking at how companies are using the technology, what we found was that the technology investment was actually just the tip of a much larger iceberg of other investments. For instance, if you look at a large enterprise system like enterprise resource planning or CRM or SCM system, one of these modules may cost on the order of about $20 million there to implement all in. But of that, only a tiny fraction of it, less than $1 million, less than 5%, is actually new IT hardware typically, and this is an average over a large number of firms. So the part that you think of as being the hard technology is actually just a small fraction of the overall investment. Even including software, that's still less than 20% of the total if you add these first two lines together. So where is most of the investment? Well, it's in what we're calling implementation and deployment, things like process engineering, that is rethinking the business processes that are needed to take full advantage of technology, the way you do your inventory, the way you relate to your suppliers, the way you track information and materials flows, or the way you relate to customers. And that is a complicated job that involves either external consultants or internal staff or some combination of them. The second category is this deployment, which involves things like user training. At my university, we implemented SAP, and I remember before implementing it, my assistant would keep track of my research accounts with spreadsheets and a lot of post-it notes and keep track of things that way. Afterwards, she went and put it all into an SAP financial system, but to do that, she had to go and spend about 3 days of user training initially and then subsequent follow-up training. And even after being finished with that, there was a large number of phone calls to the help desk and to her colleagues and others to get things going. You can think of all of that as an investment in human capital, learning how to use the system. Now, I'm using the word investment carefully because an investment is when you make an expenditure of money in 1 year for a stream of benefits that lasts more than a year. And when companies are putting this effort into user training or process engineering, they anticipate that they will have a system that may last for a number of years. And typically, these systems peak in terms of their contribution to the company after 3 to 5 or even 7 years. So there's a long time lag there before the full benefits start kicking in, and then they start tailing off. So just as the IT hardware is an investment in a capital asset, the spending on implementation and deployment is also an investment, but it's not in a physical, tangible asset. It's in an intangible asset, which we are coming to call organizational capital, or more specifically, organizational and human capital. Let me give you a particular company that went through some of these changes, and we observed some. I see that they're featured in Business Week this week. Michael Dell visited us and described some of the changes that they were doing at that organization, and he invited me down to look at the factories they have down there and the way they were changing the work that was being done. And it was very educational for me. I got to tour the factory where they build the PCs, and they have 18 bays on the left and where materials would come in, 18 bays on the right where finished computers would go out. We were up on a platform that was like 2 stories up, and there were no walls, so you could see all the activity as it flowed from left to right, finished computers. Most of them, because they had little color tags on them, I could see would be completed within 1 day from getting the order to being shipped out. And Dick Hunter, who was giving me the tour, was very proud of their efficiency and how productive they were. We talked about productivity a lot. But I did notice that the back third, actually back 40% or so of the factory, sort of in the right corner, is just empty. There are no machinery, no inventory, no people there. And I jokingly said, well, you know, that's not very productive. You're wasting all this space. That's got to cost you a lot of money. And he said, well, you know, Eric, we used to be using it, but we don't need that space anymore. And I said, you know, I kind of ribbed him. I said, well, I know. You guys have been losing market share and struggling a little bit. And he said, no, no, no. Eric, you completely misunderstand. This is a phrase I hear a lot in my research. And I said, what do you mean? And this is what I try and learn. He said, no, we actually are producing more in this factory than we did just 4 months ago when we were using that space, but we reorganized it and we've become much more efficient, so we don't need that materials. Specifically, they implemented some new software. It happened to be i2 software, and did a big business process redesign of the way they ran the factory. And in doing so, they eliminated most of the work in process inventory and streamlined their operations. The orders would now, when they came in from their customers, would be instantly transmitted to their suppliers, each of the components that were needed. So the suppliers would deliver every 4 hours the parts that were required just in time. By doing so, not only did they eliminate the inventory, but they also made everything run much more smoothly. They were able to find defective parts or problems showed up much more quickly, and they were able to fix them. So this was a big improvement in their efficiency. I went home, and about 6 months later, I got a call from him, and he was very happy. He said, you know, I know this was bothering you, Eric, but we're now using that last 40% of the factory, so that doesn't have to be on your mind anymore. And I said, well, that's great. And he said, yeah, in fact, we're producing twice as much from that factory as we were a year ago. And as I hung up the phone, I was thinking about that a little bit, what had gone on in that transformation. Now, he was at the time in charge of operations, and his job was basically just to make sure they had the production capacity to fulfill the orders that were coming in from the sales and marketing organization. He wasn't really generating the orders, he was just filling them. And think about how he might have gone about doing his job if he hadn't done that reorganization, if he hadn't used technology to change things. How could he have doubled the capacity of his manufacturing in sort of the more traditional way? What would be the standard way to double your output? Yeah. Buy another factory. Double your capacity. Buy, you know, and there's space, you know. There's Texas, lots of empty space there. Room for another factory right next to the first one. So he easily could have built another factory and doubled his capacity without changing anything about the way they were running. And I suspect his CFO and shareholders would all be very happy with that. They'd say, hey, this is great. We're growing. We've got, you know, we've spent some money, but we've got some hard assets to show for. We've got twice as much capacity. Keep going. Keep doing it. But he didn't build a second factory. Or did he? I would argue he did build a second factory inside the first factory. But the second factory was not made out of bricks and mortar. It was made out of what? Software, business processes. Was it a real factory? Am I just making up a story here? No, it was a real factory in terms of it produced real computers, real revenues, real profits. So in every sense, economic sense, it was a real factory. But it was an intangible factory. It was made of intangible assets. And I think that is a microcosm of what has been going on in the U.S. economy, not just in manufacturing, but in retailing and banking and services, many other sectors, where companies are using software and IT to transform the way they're doing their business. And to make that work, they are rethinking their business processes. And it's creating real assets, but they're intangible assets. And they don't show up in a lot of the conventional accounting. In fact, we did this work with Adam Saunders that we did. We cite in the book, we did some research analysis of these, and we calculated that there's close to $2 trillion, that's with a T, $2 trillion of intangible assets that have been created in conjunction with the computerization of American firms in the way that I just described at Dell, or the earlier example with the enterprise systems, where companies are making complementary investments in a set of changes that are creating valuable assets, but they don't show up in most of the GDP statistics, they don't show up on the balance sheets of the companies, but they are showing up in terms of greater productivity and performance. In fact, that is the reason why we've had this uptick in productivity, is because companies have figured out how to make these kinds of changes. A small tip of technology investment enables a larger, less visible set of complementary organizational and human capital investments. Now, we wanted to be more formal about this. In the book, we describe it in more detail. And so we went about gathering a great deal of data on this. And the National Science Foundation helped support this to the tune of about $5 million. And we went out to gather data, and the fifth bullet here talks about organizational assets. We went out to measure those because they don't show up in the national statistics. The Census Bureau doesn't collect them, although I've been having some meetings. We're hoping to have them start collecting them. CompuStat, Standard & Poor's, nobody else is collecting data on this type of asset. It wasn't that hard to get data on revenues, market value, and ordinary capital labor. Those kinds of inputs we were able to get data on. But the only way we could get data on organizational assets was by going out and measuring them ourselves, and we did that through a series of interviews with the executives in these companies and managers in these companies. Each interview took about 20 minutes, and we compiled the data. We asked them a set of questions about their changes in business processes, their hiring procedures, the allocation of decision rights, their incentive systems, training budgets and processes, all those kinds of questions, and use that to construct a metric of their organizational capital. So there's a series of academic papers, a lot of equations in there, but I won't go into those in much detail except to give you the bottom line results. There are three key findings here. The first one is that we identified a distinctly different set of business practices that were common to companies that were heavy IT users. So we call these the digital organization. This is not just because it's not companies that are making IT, these are companies that use a lot of IT. And what we found was that the use of IT was correlated with a different set of business practices. So this goes back to many other times when historically, when new technologies have been introduced, it's coincided with new ways of working, new ways of getting business done, like when Henry Ford introduced the assembly line. Secondly, these new practices were correlated with higher performance. So this wasn't just a, pardon the expression, academic finding. This was a finding that had real business implications. That scatter plot I showed you earlier, where some firms were above the regression line and some were below, remember that scatter? Well, the ones that were above the regression line disproportionately had adopted these different business practices of the digital organization. And then thirdly, and I think this is the most intellectually interesting finding, I'll see if you guys agree. We found that the investments in this digital organization and investments in IT were complementary to one another, meaning that they were more valuable together than they were separately. There were some firms that did one or the other, and more firms that did both of them together, and they had different levels of performance. Now, complementarity is an economic term that means that it's like synergy. My left shoe is complementary to my right shoe. My left shoe is valuable, but not so valuable by itself. It's more valuable along with the shoe. Software is complementary to hardware. Different components of machines are complementary to one another. And what we found was that processes could also be complementary to one another. It's not as intuitive, perhaps, but it shows up in the economics. And here's the kind of chart that we like to make at MIT. It's a nice 3D chart. So it's similar to the scatter plot I showed you earlier, but now I've added a third dimension. Horizontally, we have how much IT capital the firm is using. And vertically is a measure of performance. Actually, I switched it. Before it was productivity, now it's market value. But the charts look fairly similar. It's actually a little prettier in market value, so I'm showing you that one. The new dimension is digital organization. And that is how much of these practices they have adopted. And I'll describe what they are in a little more detail. The ones towards the back in this third dimension have done a lot of the changes, and the ones towards the front haven't. And the surface here is where the firms lay primarily, sort of the best fit through all the firms. And what you see, well, let me just make sure you don't miss the forest for the trees. The big story is that firms that combine IT with changes in their business practices have much higher performance than firms that do one or the other, or that do neither for that matter. For instance, look along the front lip here. These are firms with different levels of IT, but they all have fairly traditional organizations. They haven't made any changes in their business. And what you see is that even companies that have used a lot of IT aren't really any better off, don't have any higher value than the companies that didn't invest in IT, if they didn't also make those business changes. In fact, the ones in the middle, there seems to be sort of a dip there of firms that did particularly badly. If you go along the left side here, those are companies that tried to implement these new business practices but did not have the IT infrastructure to support them. They also did not do very well. But the firms that did both that's where the vast majority of the high performers were. I guess I feel especially bad for these firms that are sort of in the middle here. Those are companies that kind of made halfway steps. They made some changes, they bought some computers, they made half-hearted attempts to change their culture. And you might think they would get half the results. Unfortunately, that's not the way it worked out. They actually did even worse than the companies that didn't do anything. So not necessarily fair, but that's the way, what the data tell us is what happened. So there were a set of specific practices that constitute this digital organization. And let me describe what those are. The first one, fairly obvious, was that these companies made measurable changes from analog business processes, paper-based processes, like paper expense forms or reporting procedures, to digital business processes. And we had a set of those. And obviously, the more IT intensive you are, the more you're going to make those changes. So it's not shocking, but it is, of course, part of the system. The other six practices are ones that aren't, by definition, related to IT, but they turned out to be correlated with it. So this is a data-driven study. We did not impose this list and see if it was true. Instead, we let the data speak and see which practices were correlated with technology. And these other six practices, the seven altogether, were strongly correlated with more use of IT. We found that they were more likely to distribute their decision-making, less likely to have a small group in charge of all the decisions. So we had a whole set of questions about who was responsible for different kinds of tasks. And on average, these firms were statistically significantly more likely to delegate more broadly and have people in the field being able to make decisions. They fostered more open information access. And by that, I mean there was more information flow horizontally. There's also more information flow vertically. In fact, every way we measured it, I kind of had read the literature. I thought we'd see more horizontal and less vertical. I was half right. It was more horizontal and more vertical. So how were we measured it? They were also more likely to use performance pay and do things that linked incentives to performance, team-based performance, individual performance. Stock options was actually just borderline. It was not quite significant, but it was almost significant. But most of the other metrics were linked in that way. They had a clear program for maintaining focus and communicating their goals. So we had a set of questions about that. For instance, it was much more common to have senior management or the CEO communicate on a weekly basis, or in some cases a daily basis, what the vision was. A lot of them had these little cards. This is something I hadn't known that companies had before, but apparently a lot of them have these little culture cards where they describe the vision for the company on this little card. Like, for instance, Cisco has one where they have the 11 principles of their organization, and been going around asking more companies if they have them. We don't have one at MIT, but a lot of other companies apparently have them, and that was much more common. They're work harder to hire the best people. Now, of course, if we just asked, do you want to hire the best people, everybody would say, yes, we're in that group. So we tried to be a little more discerning about what group they were in, and we asked them a set of questions about how many candidates they interviewed for each slot, how many interviews each candidate had to go through, what kinds of objective metrics they had, if any, whether management and senior management were involved in hiring decisions or whether it was delegated to HR. And once again, what we found was that there was a statistically significant difference between the IT-intensive firms and the others. And finally, once they got hired, we found these people were more likely to invest heavily in training and education by the number of days per year, number of dollars spent on it, and the other metrics. Even though they worked harder to get good people in the first place, they also invested more once they were hired. Do you have a question? Yes?
Yeah, so did you identify whether IT investment is actually endogenous out of those organizational factors? What makes a firm want to make more IT investment? Is that because they want to implement a horizontal organization structure, or they make IT investment first and then they have to make those changes?
Right, that's a great question. So which came first? And so the way I was thinking about it when I first did this work was that IT was driving a set of other organizational changes. But I think that's actually too simple. I think that in talking to more of them, it's really much more of a continuous feedback loop that goes in both directions. So these are all part of a complementary system that reinforce each other. And in fact, a subsequent paper we did was called The Virtuous Cycle, which looked at some of the IT investments triggering some organizational changes, which then triggered new IT investments and also performance changes, and you could see the cycle going back and forth. And if you get it right, you get into kind of a virtuous cycle where things build in a better and better way. So I don't think I can answer your question saying that it all went from IT to organization or all from organization to IT. It really is part of a system that all fits together. And this concept that I've used more and more in my work of complementarity, for me at least, has been very useful as a way of framing this, the idea that these things fit together like a watch, components of a watch. Does that answer your question? Okay, good. Well, let me ask you a question. Maybe you can help me with my research going forward. So here's a cluster of practices, and we've identified that they are correlated with better performance. But why now? If this set of practices here is so much better, and it is measurably better, then why haven't firms been doing this all along? Why are we seeing such a dispersion? In fact, if anything, it looks like the evidence is that the dispersion has been growing in recent years in performance and adoption. Yes?
Okay, so you mentioned
the feedback
loops.
The what?
The feedback loops.
Yes.
I suppose this comes from system dynamics. So mm-hmm. MIT. Yeah. So you probably have started to measure the delays.
Yeah, that's very good. So one way to do this is use system dynamics, which a lot of people at MIT like to use, and it does describe how there can be a feedback loop between different things, the way I was just describing that organization. Yeah?
What else? The other factor is also competition. I mean, I think that if you look at it from 5 years ago or 10 mm-hmm. years ago, mm-hmm. the level of competition that you have sector by sector, mm-hmm. and you look at correlate that with either market value, Tobin's Q, whatever value you use, mm-hmm. the level of competition. Mm-hmm. And it's not just country-specific, it's uh-huh. global. So if you're trying to compete across platforms outside your own home market, you have to change forced to adopt new practices
in order to compete. Right. So before, maybe you had a little bit of slack, and you know, GM, to pick on one company, could sort of sit back and not make a lot of changes, but then competition forces them to make some changes. I mean, I'm impressed you guys talking about endogeneity and system dynamics and Tobin's Q. You've got a pretty economically literate group of people that come to these things. So, but I think that, yeah, I can see that could also be a big part of the story. In fact, this morning when we were meeting with Chairman Bernanke, there was a big discussion about this interaction, about how competition, either across countries or within different industries, drives organizational change and prevents companies from sort of having a lot of slack and not making those kinds of changes. It seems to be one of the strongest indicators of those things. Any other hypotheses? Yes?
But information technology itself makes it possible. You can't measure productivity as well or communicate between.
Yeah, that's a really important one, and I'm glad you brought it up. I mean, if you tried to do this 100 years ago, you wouldn't have the... you wouldn't have be able to do the first component of it, and it sort of is enabling this whole set of other changes. And so technology is sort of a catalyst that enables these other changes. I think that's a really key part of it, because I think people have, when I looked at this list and it came up, I mean, people have talked about some of these ideas for a long time. It's not like I invented this list, or that people couldn't think that, okay, this, you know, incentives to performance, let's just do that. But I think one of the reasons it hasn't been done before is that it didn't have the kind of returns it does now. If you weren't able to measure performance carefully and make the rewards, then that probably wouldn't pay off. And if you talk about, say, distributing decision rights, but if the people didn't have the information needed to make those decisions, then they're not going to make very good decisions. You know, if you say, go, you decide, but they don't have access to the data that's required. And of course, opening information access, all these things, in part, are strengthened by information technology. Yeah.
The other point with number two, that's kind of an interesting point with distributing decision rights.
Yeah.
If you look at the role of the CIO, for example, and I work in the healthcare sector in hospitals, the shift has been from sort of a purely tactical perspective to being much more strategic, because the level of investment is higher, and you have more inclusion of technology management being included at a higher level, at a board level, at a governance level, which has continued.
Yeah.
A couple of years ago, you really didn't see that. It was really delegated as a separate part of the business.
Yeah. So I think the role of the CIO has changed quite a bit from being just a sort of technologist to being having to understand all these other aspects of it. And if the CIO doesn't understand the changes in the business processes, and for that matter, the marketing and HR and other components, then she or he's not going to be able to do a very good job of such changing. The other thing that and this took me a while to get, but I think I understand it now, is that there's certain types of decisions, and the ones that we ended up asking about that get distributed, but other types of decisions are becoming more centralized. And what seems to be going on is that decisions that can be quantified or structured are often becoming more centralized. So financial and other kinds of numbers, things that can be computerized, whereas things that require a lot of tacit knowledge and on-the-spot information or human interactions are getting pushed out to the people who have those kinds of interactions. So there's kind of things going in two directions, the human kinds of decisions versus the ones that can be more automated. So that's part of what's going on. Another interesting finding is, so most of our metrics in our study were focused on business performance, productivity, profitability, market value. We did have a few questions about employees. Now, in retrospect, I wish we'd asked more about this, but it was interesting. When we asked a few questions about them, what we found was that employees were also better off. So one of my concerns was that maybe the way that this is working is it's creating kind of an electronic sweatshop that's allowing people to measure things more and more carefully and squeeze every last bit of value from them. And it might make the stockholders better off, but it's just a zero-sum game if it's squeezing suppliers or employees. We did not find that to be the case. What we found was that, in fact, employees were also better off. On average, they were paid more. With different parts of the organization, we measured top, middle, and bottom of the pay scale. They were less likely to quit, had higher levels of satisfaction. So we interpreted, the fact that they stayed with the company more also as indications that they were not dissatisfied. So that suggests that it's kind of a win-win, that yes, there's value for the company, but it's not a zero-sum squeezing. It's actually creating a bigger pie and allowing more parts to go to different people. So it's a true productivity gain, not just an artificial one. So another question that comes to mind then is why all firms haven't adopted this set of practices. And it's similar to the question we raised earlier, and I want to suggest that part of the story has to do with these complementarities. So one of the models that we're using to study this is a tool called the Matrix of Change, which looks at the interactions between different business processes and different business practices. And what we have here, whoops, pushed the wrong button, let's see, here we go. What we have here is the seven practices that I mentioned before. And what I'm emphasizing with this diagram is that these are not independent, separate practices you can implement one at a time, but rather that they reinforce each other. And each of these little plus signs represents a complementarity that we have identified between a pair of the practices. For instance, let's say analog to decision, analog to digital processes is complementary to open information access. So if you want to have a policy of sharing information, well, that's hard to do if everything's paper-based. You know, you make photocopies and send them around to everybody. I don't know. That's possible, but it's not very cost-effective. Whereas if you have a central database or a wiki, electronic communications, it becomes much easier to have those kinds of sharing. So that means that if you want to implement this process, it's a lot easier to also implement this process. The two of them go together and they're complementary. And I'm not going to go through all each of these pluses in here, but what we found was when we looked at it, we found that there's a whole cluster of complementarities. In practice, what that means is that if you implement only one or two or a subset of these practices, you're not getting the full value from the system. To get the full value from the system, you need to implement them all together. And that means that it can be very difficult to actually move from an old system to a new system. There's a lot of inertia. You can't do it piecemeal. Back to my analogy with my watch here. This particular watch is a mechanical watch. It's got little gears inside that spin around and turn the hands. Now, if I want to turn this into a digital watch, I could, you know, I hear digital watches are more accurate and have all sorts of cool features. I could go and take some transistors out of a digital watch, and I could open the back of this, and I could put them in here, maybe get rid of a couple of the gears to make room for it. But I don't think that would make this watch become more accurate. As I gradually added more and more transistors and circuits, it wouldn't give me a nice smooth transition to a digital watch. It's something you either have to do all or nothing. And it's very obvious and intuitive for us to see that with physical objects. We interact with them all the time. It's not so intuitive when we think about business processes and intangible components. Yet, that's very much what's going on here. These pieces need to fit together. They structure and reinforce each other like the gears of a wheel. And if you only change some of the practices without others, you may end up making yourself worse off. And that's why I think a lot of companies are stuck with an outdated set of practices. And they may very sincerely want to make changes. Maybe parts of the organization see that a particular practice is working in one of their competitors or some firm they've studied or something they read in Sloan Management Review or Harvard Business Review. But if you just go and implement it piecemeal, it's not necessarily going to work. In fact, it could easily make you worse off if you don't have appreciation of these complementarities. Yes, question?
Just a question.
Yeah.
So
for this particular data set, for data availability purposes, we had to work with publicly traded firms. So they're all fairly large. And in fact, in the process of winnowing down, we ended up with a sample of, I guess, like close to 1,000. But they were disproportionately larger firms. And compared to the U.S. economy, they were somewhat more manufacturing. It was almost 40 to 50% manufacturing. So it wasn't a random sample of firms, I should make that caveat. We did find some patterns, which I wish I'd had some non-publicly traded firms, but we couldn't get the right data. We did find that within the publicly traded firms, age did make a difference. So the older and bigger firms tended to have a harder time making this transition, whereas the relatively younger firms, and interesting both in terms of the age of the company, and also in terms of the age of the average employee, either of those definitions of younger tended to be more likely to have moved towards that quadrant, that high quadrant. But one of the things that I'm hoping to do maybe in some future research would be to get data from you know, more startups and smaller and private traded firms. The difficulty, I mean, I remember I had that list of all the data we needed, and it's easy to get most of that from publicly traded firms, but not for private firms. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thanks.
Okay, great. So let me just summarize here, and we can have more questions if you'd like after that. Sometimes this works, and sometimes it doesn't. But we only got a couple slides, so I'll just... even the button doesn't work. About the wonders of technology here, okay.
Productivity only organizations that don't use PowerPoint?
I don't know. Yeah, there you go. That's probably the main lesson to take away. She's got the magic touch. She did it before. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's a good, better use of our time than watching the screen.
In your book or elsewhere, mm-hmm. have you talked about the application of many of these same kind of concepts to public sector organizations?
Yeah.
When you were talking about size and age, and I thought, well, you know, government is like a Fortune 1 company.
Right.
And it's tried.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So that's a great question. Unfortunately, for the same reason in answer to the previous question, we don't have data. It's hard to get performance metrics on government organizations, which is maybe why they are government organizations. You know, it's not a coincidence. But we can do two things. One, we can sort of make analogies, and it seems intuitive to me that you know, it makes sense that a lot of the same practices would carry over. I can't say that we've proven that or shown that empirically, but the underlying mechanisms that affect these organizations are likely to affect other kinds of organizations as well, whether they're privately traded organizations or government organizations. And then secondly, there has been a limited amount of work on public organizations. So Frank Lichtenberg at Columbia has done some work where he found some very similar patterns. And the government does have a set of performance metrics that they do for different agencies. And he used those performance metrics and found some similar kinds of results to these, mostly relating IT and the performance metrics, not so much these specific practices. But it gave me some confidence that there are similar principles at work there. But again, that would be the kind of thing that would be great to be able to get additional data on. To carry that over. So to summarize then, there are four main takeaways that we have from this part of the research and that are summarized in those two chapters of the book. The first is that indeed IT has been the catalyst for this big productivity surge we've seen. It's really very important, actually. I want to underscore, even though I mentioned a few percentage points, a lot of people may not realize how much that can make a difference. If productivity grows at 1% per year, it takes about 70 years for living standards to double. If productivity grows at 4% per year, it takes only 16 or 17 years for living standards to double. And after 32 years, they've quadrupled. And after 64 years, they're 16 times higher. So it makes a big difference if you can increase productivity by even a few percentage points. And we've done that recently. So the fact that IT has helped with that is really quite significant to our ability to deal with a whole host of societal issues. While IT has been a catalyst for this change, the other really important lesson is that most of the real investment has not been in the visible IT part, but in the less visible, intangible organizational capital. And in fact, the payoff doesn't seem to occur in most firms unless you make both of those investments together. That companies that make one without the other are much less likely to succeed. We've identified seven specific practices that are part of this digital organization, and those came from the data. I don't think those are the only seven practices, but those are the ones that we were able to detect, and we continue to research to identify other ones, and they showed up very clearly. And finally, it's important to think of these as not individual practices, but rather as part of an overall coherent system, a system that fits together like a watch. And that, I believe, is a big part of the reason why it's so difficult for companies to make this transition. Even if they've identified a lot of what needs to be done, unless you have a coherent plan, you may end up failing and in some ways making your organization worse off. So if you want to know more details about how we did this research or some of the specific findings, please feel free to pick up the book and feel free to email me or ask me questions about it. In fact, we have a few minutes now if any of you have questions or comments on the book. Yes?
I guess you've looked at sort of an aggregate. My challenge in applying some of the practice, you showed that slide with the implementation for the ERP system, the same challenge exists to put an electronic medical record in a hospital, which is quite crazy.
Right.
The challenge in the medical environment is, you know, the complexity level, especially in the ED or ICU or OR, is so much higher.
Exactly.
The consequences of error are so much higher. So
right.
if you do the wrong things, you put in the wrong software system, or the workflow changes for an intensivist is somehow not there, the consequences is that people die.
Yeah.
So you know, it's not the same. I mean, I know you talked about Dell factor. So to me, it's like the digital Pareto effect. You're saying that it's the 80-20 rule, so you've got 75-25. So you're within that 75%, you're identifying a whole host of practices that are made fixed. The challenge is, and I've gone through this, is that when you're doing a benefits realization study on the planning phase, it's very hard to justify to the people who are making the capital investment, which is the board, the CEO of the hospital, whoever it is, because they don't really see it. They think, look, we've got to spend $20 million or $25 million on this investment. We're not sure. It's a leap into the unknown whether we're going to get that value or not. And this isn't a theoretical question because now the government's involved in, you know, giving us incentives to do this. I guess I'm just
sure. No, I think you made a number of really good points there. Let me underscore them.
Sure.
First off, I think you're absolutely right that the health sector is one of the areas that is furthest behind in this transition. I can't believe how many, you know, physicians are still doing paper records. I mean, can you imagine going to a bank and making a deposit and someone pull out a piece of paper and said, okay, let me just erase this? And, you know, it would be bizarre, and yet that's how many physicians and hospitals run their practices. And a big part of the reason is exactly, as you're saying, that the complexity of the interactions and the subtlety and the fact that the visibility isn't there in terms of the benefits. I mean, it's a problem in some of these other areas as well, where the costs are very visible. You have to write a check for them, and you know, there's no question you're going to incur many of those costs. But the benefits are not so visible. They're more intangible, and they're hoped for. And in many cases, they accrue to other parties. So it's not necessarily the person who's writing the check, and health, you know, maybe that may be part of it as well. But the complexity of these interactions. So, you know, I described 7 sets of interactions. You know, to really truly do the healthcare sector, it'd probably be, you know, 700 interactions. And what makes it worse is that there's a lot of different parties involved, some of whom are responsible for one set and others the other set. So you put this together, and you can understand why it's been so difficult to get over the hump there. It has been done in some organizations. You know, the VA and other organizations in certain medical systems have made that transition. In other countries, like we were just talking, Rob and I were just about talking about it, because it was Denmark, were you saying, that had made much more progress. So I'm hopeful that it will happen, especially if we have a roadmap of what some of the benefits are going to be. And something like this should really be done specifically for the medical sector, because I'm sure there are a lot of unique characteristics. But if it can be done, the benefits could be quite enormous. And I'm one of those who believes that overall, in coming years, that sector is going to be one of the drivers of the economic growth in the economy, because health is very important to people, and it's justifiable that we'd want to spend some money in that area. Yeah, in the back. Yeah, so you're absolutely right. This was motivated by managers and executives in private companies. What could we do? What should we be thinking about? But it's interesting to think about, especially in this city, what are some of the things that policymakers can do, what can government do? And so I think there are a set of things. First off, just a better understanding and diffusion of what best practices are. I think that there's a long list of things that might work or could work, and here's a set that has been shown that is working in a particular set of practices, of education, diffusion about that. Secondly, one of the things that makes IT investments more productive is if you can make the complementary organizational changes. But those complementary organizational changes are very disruptive, and they require changing people's jobs, in some cases laying people off, reassigning. And so if you have rigid labor markets, it becomes very difficult to make those kinds of changes. There are many things that governments can do to make their labor markets more flexible, to allow for retraining and ways that people can change from one job to another or one industry to another more easily. If people are locked in to particular companies or industries, then it's more difficult to make those kinds of changes. Providing an infrastructure for some of the technology capabilities is beneficial as well, especially some common standards. The internet, for instance, has unleashed a flood of innovations in that sector, and part of it is because there are actually some, think of the internet as being very flexible, but there's also some very strong standards and requirements. TCP/IP is very restrictive in many ways, but it allows a flourishing of innovation in terms of how it's used. But there was a core set of requirements there. So those are some of the things that can be done. I should mention education as well as something that if you're going to have people changing jobs and learning new skills and capabilities, the more educated and flexible the workforce is, the easier that's going to happen. And companies and countries that don't have that kind of a workforce have a harder time. In fact, those are some of the practices that are listed as part of the digital organization as well. So those are some of the ones, but I should, and that's sort of thinking through what's going on. I think your question kind of motivates me to want to sit down and write a more cohesive policy-oriented version of this analysis that would try to bring some of those together, because I could see how that'd be very useful. Yeah?
At the beginning, you talked about the international differential in terms of productivity measurements.
Yes.
Couple of questions on that. How confident are you that, in hindsight, those data will hold up? For example, in the financial era, mm-hmm. and area, we had a lot of very positive data, and then it all fell apart, and now we're even recalculating GDP performance. The second thing, if we assume that U.S. performance in the past was superior, how confident are you going forward that differential will be maintained?
Mm-hmm.
You talked about labor markets and so on, so of course they are more flexible here than in most places, but then you also started talking about countries like Denmark that are, you know, like a state in the United States by size. Mm-hmm. But so is there going to be more competition on the IT productivity front than the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
has encountered in the past, which is a fortunate period, or is there something systemic where we're going to keep pushing it forward?
So set of questions in there. Let me see if I can touch on each of them. In terms of the financial sector, there's definitely some inflated numbers there, but people have gone and controlled for that, and it doesn't change the basic story here. So we're still on pretty firm ground in terms of the productivity revival being quite significant and even continuing more strongly more recently. In terms of connections to other countries, most of the post-war period, there's actually kind of a convergence with Europe and other countries catching up. That ended in 1995, where now the U.S. has started pulling away. Again, it continues to the current period. I think from what I've seen, it's likely that that's going to continue insofar as these kinds of practices that I described here continue to be more prevalent in the United States. And Nick Bloom, who is one of the other people with me presenting at the Fed this morning, actually had some interesting data where he looked not just at different countries, but I think very interestingly looked at multinationals from different countries that went to different countries. So you could kind of get some controlling for what was going on, what was home effect versus the country that it was in. And what he found was that U.S.-based multinationals in other countries brought with them a set of organizational and management practices that were measurably more productive, similar to the list I listed here, when they went to Britain or France or other countries, whereas multinationals from other countries didn't bring those same set of practices. So that, to me, was pretty good evidence that there was, in fact, something specific about the practices being brought or the technology being brought from the United States. That said, there are some warning signs that are more negative. For instance, it used to be that people who came from a lot of countries like India and China and Korea and trained in the United States would stay here to continue to contribute to especially our technology sectors and other sectors because there really was no viable sector back in their own country where they could apply those skills. That's no longer true. Now they could go back, say, to India and in many cases do just as well or better as they would in Silicon Valley or Boston or wherever. So that's something that's, for the United States, a negative. It's probably a positive for the world as a whole, but that's something that's going to bring more competition and level the playing field. But it's still there's still a pretty big gap in most categories, and there seems to be somewhat of a division of labor. If you look at, say, like my iPhone here, a lot of technology, the U.S. now has a trade deficit in computers and electronics, but it's because, as it says here, you know, this phone was designed by Apple in California and assembled in China. And there's a common pattern where the work is being divided up in that way, where many of the more high value-added parts are still being done in the United States. Now, whether or not we can continue to race ahead, because other countries will catch up in some of those design characteristics, is a question that's going to depend on some of the things like public policy and the other changes we do to maintain that kind of a lead. But it's not something that we can count on if we don't keep making those investments. Somebody new here, yeah?
I'd like to just follow up on what you just said. Do you draw any public policy conclusions out of this? If you look at what does it take to set a policy environment here in the U.S. or other countries, for that matter, that can continue to encourage innovation with a focus on IT and the role of IT, have you drawn any conclusions?
Well, I've listed some of them earlier. Maybe the other one that I would probably want to stress more would be the education level, because I think that you can't necessarily predict exactly which types of technologies are going to be the ones that are going to pay off and going to be most in demand. But the more skilled the workforce is, and the more skilled the innovators are, the more likelihood you're going to be able to keep ahead. And that really, it addresses a number of concerns with one policy instrument. One of the things that we haven't talked about, but it has also been growing income inequality in the United States. It's happened over the past two decades. And in other work, we've linked that also to information technology, and technology investments have helped exacerbate that problem. One of the reasons is that these technology investments require a more skilled workforce, and so there have been increasing returns to education and skills. If you make investments in those, then you help narrow that wage gap, and also you raise the overall level of innovation and of productivity in an organization. That's the kind of thing that traditionally has fallen on the shoulders of the public sector to work on. Yeah?
Question about intangible assets.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that there are intangible assets, but mm-hmm. if I recall during the dot-com bubble, a lot of equity analysts looked at typically startups, and so
yeah.
they have a lot of intangible assets,
right.
and therefore their stock price
right.
ought to be very, very high
right.
and worth a lot more money than they actually turned out to be. So I guess, how do you deal with that?
Yeah. Exactly. This is a real problem. And you can clearly take it too far and make a mistake. I think during that period, they're counting eyeballs and saying discount dollars, that overshooting it and say throw away all the other metrics. That was clearly a mistake. For that matter, there was an overshooting just plain IT investment. And so I think that in 1999, between Y2K and the internet craze and everything, a lot of companies invested even beyond the optimal point. So although I'm a technology optimist and I'm also a believer that there are important intangible assets, it's quite possible to take either of those too far, and the examples you just gave are, I think, are cases where they are taken too far. And there's a big leap between the insights I tried to make about the importance of intangible assets to translating that to a dollar value on someone's balance sheet. I'm very comfortable saying that there are trillions of dollars of intangible assets in the U.S. economy. We need to manage and pay attention to them. I'm not comfortable putting those on a company's balance sheet and saying, you know, having Dell write down, you know, we have a $200 million factory and we have a $200 million intangible factory, and putting that on their balance sheet, because it is, as you point out, so much harder to pin that down. Maybe it's not really worth that amount. There's too much discretion in doing that. So as an accountant, I wouldn't necessarily do the same thing as I would do as an economist, an accountant who is accountable to having to have a precise number for bondholders and stockholders, versus trying to get a general picture of what's happening in the economy. That's there's still a ways to go between those. Maybe one more question over here.
We got time for a few more.
A few more. Okay, yeah. Go ahead.
Okay. The impression I get from your talk and also from reading some of your papers is that you're associated organizational capital specifically with IT. Mm-hmm. So it sounds like when a company makes IT investment, this is a one-time investment of certainly like a platform or software. And then it makes a one-time investment in organizational changes. Mm-hmm. So those are like creative destruction. Mm-hmm. They are like one-time changes. Mm-hmm. But still you classify those investment as investment. They create capital, which means they depreciate and you reinvest. Mm-hmm. And there's a way to calculate a stock mm-hmm. of organization capital out of this process, continuous mm-hmm. process. So it seems like the two are, I think there's a discrepancy.
Sure. Let me go. First off, there's two discrepancies I think you brought up. One is are all intangible assets IT related? And I think the answer is certainly no. There are lots of other intangible assets associated with brand, patents, and other characteristics of an organization. For that matter, business process changes that were not IT enabled. Those are all important. I highlight the role of IT-enabled ones because IT is so different today from 20 years ago or 40 years ago, whereas the other characteristics have been relatively invariant in the economy. So for instance, human capital has always been important in the economy, but IT has really taken off, and therefore the intangibles associated with IT have become much more important in recent years and have gone from zero to a few trillion dollars, whereas the other ones were large and always and haven't changed. So that's in the research I focused on the one that's changing, but I don't want to argue that the other ones don't exist. They're still important. Now, in terms of the one-time investment versus ongoing investment, you're absolutely right. You characterize it exactly correctly that intangible assets, just like tangible assets, depreciate over time. So those business process changes that a company makes, they may be valuable, but after some number of years, they're obsolete and they're no longer appropriate. Now, what that number of years is going to depend on the process change in the industry and a lot of other things. And therefore, you'll need to make continuing investments if you want to maintain your intangible capital stock, exactly analogous to if you wanted to maintain your physical capital stock. You'd have to make continuing investments. In my talk, and I think in fairness, probably in my papers, I stress the one shot, you know, you make this investment and then there's some intangibles with it, more just for clarity. And actually, I apologize, it may have reduced the clarity by making it seem like those other investments were important. But you're right, they are important. And in addition to having that initial investment, like building a factory, there's also investments that have to be made along the way to maintain your capital stock. And I think the analogy is pretty tight between the intangibles and the tangibles. Yep?
First, appreciate your comments, and Bob, thanks for the event. You talked about the implications for private sector decision-making, and ergo, potentially public sector decision-making. You know, implicit in the digital organization, and you touched on it in terms of an iPhone, is you know, a global delivery model, not just in terms of physical product, but information. Mm-hmm. Business process outsourcing, the whole nine yards. You talk about potentially being able to better measure, you know, data in terms of digital organization. I would think, and do you foresee the potential, going back to the public policy argument, that we could provide some data on the potential public policy benefits of a digital organization when they're trying to achieve a public policy goal, like reduced healthcare costs, like being able to deliver more energy to communities more efficiently, or to better oversee or stabilize the financial regulatory system, things of that nature. Do you foresee the potential to provide that kind of data to provide policymakers some examples of why these types of models are effective and shouldn't be too much tampered with, so to speak?
No, I think they should be tampered with. That we need to change the kinds of data we have access to, and I hope. Well, in the meeting this morning at the Fed, one of the people there made the point that there's an opportunity to really change the types of data that are used in public decisions. Historically, we've relied on the Bureau of Economic Analysis, and these are these aggregate data that are often not just months but years old in some cases to make decisions about how the economy is going. But because of the digital revolution, we now have real-time data from supermarket scanners, clickstream data from web companies. I've done research where we have email data inside of organizations about who's talking to whom and how those connections are working. I have a new paper out using Google Trends data. You guys may know that you can go to Google and see what words, keywords are being searched on, and it turns out that that's very predictive of, say, future purchases of houses and housing prices. So all of those kinds of micro, there's about 100 billion searches done on Google that way. So that you're getting very, very fine-grained, detailed data about not just people's purchases in real time, but even their intentions and what the things they're thinking about, possibly looking at. All of that information can and should be used in public policy to track what's working, what's not working, the direction of the economy, what's happening in different sectors. Right now there's a gargantuan gap between all this terabytes of data versus what's actually being used to analyze policy, and those need to be matched up. The private sector, I think, has been much more aggressive, or at least some portion of the private sector, in making that match. There are many companies that have put the data to work in terms of what their companies are doing, what's happening inside their factories, real-time information flows. Over the next, I hope, not more than 5 or 10 years, we should be able to put a lot of that data to work in public policy, and I think it's going to be a revolution that gives us much more fine-grained understanding of what's happening in the economy. The analogy I sometimes have made is to the invention of the microscope. I don't think it's an exaggeration. When Antoni von Leeuwenhoek invented the microscope and for the first time showed that blood had individual cells in it, they didn't know that before. That led to a revolution in biology and in ultimately medicine and health performance. Today we're getting similarly fine-grained information on the data flows inside the economy of what's happening inside of companies and between companies and inside bureaucracies that just was completely opaque, invisible before. And I believe it's going to lead to a similar revolution in management practice and economics and the way our policies are measured and designed.
Maybe I can take the last
prerogative
here. A couple things. It seems to me on the public policy side, one issue is, as you just alluded to, data flows, is to make sure that we don't restrict data flows. Like, for example, in healthcare, there's a move to restrict data flows, even fully anonymized healthcare data to use for what we call rapid learning networks. Second point, though, on the public policy thing, and Eric goes back to the point, the discussion we had earlier, why is the U.S. leading? Why are we ahead? Why are U.S. companies ahead? Why do they invest more? Why do they get more out of it? Why are they more digital? And one thought is, as we talked about earlier, is related to cost, and that's, for example, a number of countries impose tariffs on IT imports. Argentina's doing this now. The EU wants to do this. China's done it in the past. India. That'd be one thing that raises costs. Second thing, as a sort of speculative thing, is Europe and a lot of other countries have that, and if you think about it, 90% is sort of below the iceberg on the services side. They're essentially, by using that, they're raising the price of IT services more than we would, and that may make it harder for companies, because that's in some of these countries, 14-18% tax essentially on IT services. So I'm just wondering if you have a thought on that.
Well, definitely agree on the tariffs. I mean, that's very transparent that when you have tariffs on importing, you know, IT equipment, that can lead to a big difference. And often you see these very large differences, 40 or 50% or more differences in the cost of identical components in across different countries. And you know, you don't have to be an expert economist to see that's going to reduce the demand for those products. And ultimately, the other 9/10 of the iceberg as well, because it's all part of a complementary system. In terms of the VAT, you know, I hadn't thought about that, and I need to go and look more closely. It could be, but you'd have to do some kind of a tax incidence thing, because it's not like there aren't taxes here too. And so, you know, depending on how what the incidence is of income taxes and corporate taxes, and then how those all account, it's not obvious to me which way that's all going to shake out. It's possible it would lead to those kinds of distortions, or maybe there'd be fewer distortions. I'd have to sit down and work it through the model on that.
All right. Well, this has been fantastic. I first of all want to really encourage you all to go buy the book, or I guess you could download it online.
Yes, actually, you can. So you know, I believe in the digital stuff. So depending on how much you want the hard copy, and or if you want to read through on screen, you can do that.
Or you could get it on your ebook reader. It the whole way. So,
the thing that we discovered with the ebook reader, though, I just as a fair warning, is that a lot of the little diagrams didn't translate as well in there, so they haven't quite perfected that. So there is a little of a price to be paid for that.
Great. Well, please join me in thanking Eric for a wonderful presentation.
Thanks very much. It was a real pleasure.